It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We've seen a good number of notable protests in this country recently over the past few months and years, certainly listening to it in our news. After Election Day, protests sprung up across the nation most recently. Also, condemnation of those protesters after Election Day. And, of course, the Black Lives Matter protests have been going on since 2013. This hour, we want to discuss protesting in America from the present, also going back to the past. Later in the hour, we'll talk with historians. But first, let's start with a current protest ongoing. In fact, let's go to the site of a current protest, the Standing Rock protest in North Dakota. Here's a little bit of audio from that protest that you may have been following in the news. Demonstrators have been protesting for months against the $3.8 billion Dakota Access Pipeline. They say it poses a threat to water resources, also sacred Native American sites. The companies say the pipeline would carry Bakken shale oil more cheaply with this pipeline and safely from North Dakota through Iowa to Illinois, and then it would be en route to the Gulf Coast refineries. I want to mention an interview request to Energy Transfer Partners, that's the company overseeing the Dakota Access Pipeline project, has not been returned. But here's the way it stands right now. Nearly 1,200-mile long is this project. It's mostly complete, except for the segment planned to run over a lake in North Dakota, less than a half a mile north of the Standing Rock Indian Reservation in North Dakota. Joining us on the line is Christine Nobis. She's a founder and co-chair of Indigenous Iowa, a Native American who lived in Iowa for 10 years. We want to hope that our technology works here, the connection to North Dakota. We've been having some problems earlier today. Christine, are you there?
I am.
Great. Thank you. We hope you hold on to this connection for the next few minutes. Tell us where you are.
I am on the highest point on a hill near Ochetee Shekoan and Sikongo Iowate camps and Red Warrior camp.
Okay, tell us about your role in these protests. Why are you there? You're not a protester, I understand.
we don't call ourselves protesters. We call ourselves protectors, first of all, because that's historically what indigenous people of this continent have done. My people, Plains Cree Salto people, are roamed in this area, and so I'm here to be with my relatives, to carry on this tradition, and also because I'm an environmentalist and I worry about the future of our planet, and because I believe in our sovereignty.
What is your goal at this point?
What is my goal, or what is the goal goal of the camp?
Of the camp, of the movement.
Of the movement, to stop the pipeline in its entirety.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's a realistic goal at this point?
Yes and no. We do know that Energy Transfer Partners and their subsidiary Dakota Access Pipeline are having financial problems. The longer we stall them, the more money they lose. And as we all know, these oil giants, money is their master, essentially. So if we can take that away, then we can stop the pipeline.
Now, organizers told a news conference this past weekend at the main protest site, where there are about 5,000 people, I understand, are camped.
Probably more, actually.
Probably more. How many do you think?
You know, it's hard to say because we don't keep a tally every day. But, I mean, I could comfortably say that there could be up to 10,000 on the weekends.
Mm-hmm. And according to reports, the people have no intention of moving.
Absolutely not. In fact, I just did an interview about this exact same question. And this is unceded treaty territory. Our treaties have never been honored. But as sovereign nations, we've never been scared to fight for them and in them and for issues that are located within our territories.
Mm-hmm. What have been the encounters you've had with the authorities trying to move the movement to the people away? What have they been like? Give us a sense of that. I mean, the pictures. Yeah.
Unfortunately, I wanted one of the protectors here. So I have been to the front lines. Well, I've been to the actions, but I haven't been at the very front of the line because I'm Canadian and I have a green card. So I do not engage in any civil disobedience whatsoever. However, I did want Roy here today to speak to that. And I will tell you from personal experience, speaking to many of my relatives and allies here and from being there to see what happens, it's actually quite traumatic. The militarized police forces here are not afraid to with malice shoot people in the head or the groin with rubber bullets. They are not afraid to throw concussion grenades right at people when they're not supposed to. And that is exactly what happened to Sophia, because I know that you guys recently did an interview concerning her arm. They beat people maliciously. It's with undue force. They spray bear mace with huge massive amounts of bear mace, pepper spray, whatever it's called. They throw cans of tear gas. I experienced the tear gas, and it's a scary feeling.
Mm-hmm. Tell us what are you watching in the media coverage of this? Are you happy with the media coverage? It's certainly been growing.
I am not happy with mainstream media coverage. In fact, I was actually going to note that the coverage that NPR did on Sophia was not done properly. We need more honest coverage.
What do you feel is dishonest about the coverage, first of all?
It didn't actually go into the details of it wasn't honest about what happened. Like, the doctors actually took shrapnel out of her arm. They know a concussion grenade, took her arm.
Mm-hmm.
And like her father has done several interviews to attest to this fact. And so I am happy with some coverage. Unicorn Riot, Democracy Now, they've been our allies from the beginning. NPR has done some great coverage. CNN's even, covered us, BBC. However, the coverage is often more concerned about, like, the culture of the camp and the Native Americanness of what's going on. But we need to get to the nitty-gritty, and that is the police state that is surrounding us. And the scary situations that are occurring, the absolute racism that happens when we go into Bismarck. Like yesterday, when I was in Bismarck, people were yelling at me, put the pipeline in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of issues with this.
Tell us, for those of us who are not Native Americans, tell us how this action ties into the treatment, as you see it, of Native Americans in this country stretching back decades.
It reflects everything that we've gone through, and this is nothing new to us at all. Well, I will change my wording on that. What is new to this particular movement is that no one has been killed yet, and that we've managed to maintain this movement for this amount of time without being shut down yet. Also, the fact that this is a very unprecedented and historical event. This is a watershed moment for Native Americans in that we have over 300 nations present. And frankly, the movement is still growing. And a lot of us consider this the seventh generation prophecy. And we are ready to change the world, and we are ready to protect Mother Earth.
Mm-hmm. Is the movement being joined by non-Native Americans, white Americans?
Yes. In fact, I would say now the camps, we are outnumbered now by white people, by white allies.
Mm-hmm. Does that change the tone there? Does that change the way you're being treated?
Yes, it does. Yes.
How?
It's another way in which Native Americans have to deal with outside settler mentalities and work. Frank, these are all of these people that are coming. We are thankful that they're here, and we love them for being here. But some people just need to be educated on how to respectfully live within a Lakota, Nakota, Dakota culture, and understand that we can't just bring outside colonial-minded ideologies into the camp. See, I myself am not Lakota, Nakota, or Dakota, and I don't come into this camp expecting to follow Cree ways or to have my own way. I follow what the elders and the leadership and of the Lakota, Nakota, Dakota people want here. And so, in the same vein, white people, anybody that maybe is not indigenous needs to come in and be humble and learn and respect what is going on here.
What do you see moving forward? I see that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, now that's the group that manages this federal land where the main camp is, of protesters, has said they have this weekend no plans for forcible removal of the protesters, but anyone who remained would be considered unauthorized and could be subject to various citations. What do you see happening if people are moved from this protest area?
If it turns out that we absolutely cannot stay there, I mean, if things get to that point where we just are being either put in jail or brutalized, I mean, I can't imagine that they would, because there are schools here, there are children, there are babies, there are elders, there is sweat lodges, ceremonial areas. I mean, this is not like some place where people are squatting. This is an actual village. This is like an actual functioning, beautiful, wonderful village. And so if this happened, though, if this did actually happen, we do have a backup where we would go on to the reservation where land has been leased, and we would winterize there.
Mm-hmm. Christine, please stay with us, joining us live from North Dakota, from the site of the Standing Rock protest there in North Dakota. Joining us now to give us a very different perspective, Greg Ellsbury is with us, Boone County Sheriff. The Dakota Access Pipeline runs, of course, through Iowa, I believe 18 counties, also Boone County. Sheriff Ellsbury, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Now, protests have ceased in Iowa, in Boone County, for instance?
For now, yes.
When was the last protest in Boone County?
The last one we had was the 19th of November.
Mm-hmm. Give us a sense of what these protests have been like from your perspective in law enforcement.
Our very first protest we had was August 31st during our Farm Progress show. And even though we had a lot of arrests, you know, everybody was very cordial, didn't have problems. Many of them, you know, asked, when can I be arrested? They had their intentions of being arrested, and that's what they wanted. As it's progressed, we've noticed, I would call rogue protesters coming in from various places of the United States, Washington, D.C., California, Florida, Maine. And I don't know, you know, they're wearing masks. They're a little bit more violent, I would say. Definitely it's progressing from what we first saw.
Mm-hmm. What are the challenges for you? For instance, when do you arrest or when do you not arrest? Someone's asking you to arrest them. Do you arrest them at that point? What do they have to do to be arrested?
Well, they actually have to violate something, a trespass, disorderly conduct, something like that. And, you know, we will ask them, even though they want to be arrested, we'll ask them a second time, are you sure you want to be arrested? Yes. And then we will go ahead and arrest them if they violated something. You know, they have training programs up here, or they've had, and, you know, they may get 50 people to raise their hand that's going to be arrested. But by the time they get to the scene, some will just say, no, you know what, it's not worth it. I don't want to be arrested. And walk away.
What have your biggest challenges been in dealing with the protests as the Boone County Sheriff?
I would say probably just getting the resources put together. You know, I have a budget every year just like everybody else does, and we don't budget for things like this. So it's cost money out of our budget. We've had to call in resources, you know, transport, buses, state patrol, We've asked other agencies to come in and help, just because, you know, I have a department that's got, you know, 13 people, and we just can't be everywhere. So resources is the biggest thing, money and people.
Mm-hmm. Do you understand the protesters' grievances, their goals?
You know, I understand. You know, everybody has a right to protest, and I have no qualms about that at all. And this is something they believe in. And, you know, as far as law enforcement, even though I'm from here, and, you know, I can sympathize with the people that have the land here, it's not my call. This has happened, 3 years ago from the federal on up. We're just here to mediate. So even though I understand the protest, you know, what they want, I try to tell them, hey, we're just here to keep the peace.
Mm-hmm. Christine is in a very different area, of course, in North Dakota, but she talked about the use of force, pepper spray, mace, and so forth. Have you had to use that? Did you have to use that in Boone County with any protesters?
No, we haven't used that at all. Officers' presence, you know, that's our goal, is just, you know, officers' presence. If we can get something stopped there, we're great.
Are your officers, your deputies, having conversations with the protesters, or is this run sort of according to a procedure without sort of conversations and talk back and forth?
No, we'll talk. Protesters, they try to get this last one in particular, 19th, we didn't have very many deputies out, and that's where it was getting a little bit etchy, I think, for the deputies. There was at the time, there's only two of the deputies there, and some of these protesters who I would say are, you know, upscaling things, tried to separate our deputies.
What do you mean by that? Encircling them?
Which entailed encircling them, yeah. They would, hey, deputy, could you come over here? I got to ask you a question. And they're trying to get them separated that way. And then the deputies were saying that they were kind of getting encircled. So, you know, they had to do with, you know, cite and release, tell them to leave, just try and get out of there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Take care of the situation, but get out of there quickly.
Sheriff Ellsbury, how much do you have to keep in mind, or has that been a factor here, the tension we've had in dating back to beginning of the Black Lives Matter, the climate with law enforcement in the country and the media coverage of it? Does that figure in here to the way you cope with these protests?
Well, you always have to, you know, keep your eyes open, your ears open. You go in there, you know, very attentive. You don't know what's going to happen. You know, there are protesters. Like I say, there are protesters, and they are very, very good to deal with, very polite, and we are polite with them. And then you have protesters who, I don't know if they are paid protesters or what, but they're more of the upscale protesters who you have to kind of, you know, worry a little bit more about. Some are eco-terrorists. You know, I don't know what – I can't imagine what's going on in North Dakota, but, you know, they also have LP tanks that they're throwing, the protesters.
Where?
Molotov cocktails. This is what I've been
Okay. Well, let's – Christine is still on the line from North Dakota. Christine, when you hear Sheriff Ellsbury describe how it's been in Boone County, Iowa, what is your reaction? It sounds like a much different picture, doesn't it?
Yes. Well, as you know, I do know people from Mississippi Stand. We do communicate with Mississippi Stand. We fundraise for them. And I have been speaking about this issue actually for months. I have been speaking about white privilege and police brutality. The reason why people in Iowa largely are not brutalized in any way is because they are 90% white. Here, there's a real long history of racism between white people of North Dakota and the Native Americans here. The interactions right from the start were never set up to necessarily be cordial. I'd like to also speak about these cocktails and these whatever LP.
The reports that the sheriff has been hearing about, that we've been hearing about in the media.
Yeah, that is absolute 100% misinformation that DAPL likes to spread on their behalf, so that they can they have an excuse, a reason to justify their brutality. Also, the sheriff's county here has I've seen him speak and just outright lie about what has happened.
Are there people in the movement there trying to improve the relationship with law enforcement there to have it more cordial?
Yes, from the very beginning. If you do some research, you will see videos from the very beginning of this whole entire movement of our elders, with our pipe carriers, our youth leadership, going up to the police line and shaking hands with them, intentionally walking up to them, shaking hands, hugging them, trying to show them respect, trying to create a relationship, trying to get them to understand how deeply we feel about our land and about protecting our Mother Earth, and how our sovereignty has been trodden upon over and over and over again, and how we just want to communicate that with them. But they will not have it. They will not have it.
Mm-hmm. Greg Aylesbury, as you hear the account, this firsthand account from Christine Nobis in North Dakota, what are your thoughts? We were going to end the segment here in about a minute here from the law enforcement perspective up there. Have a reaction?
She says it's from DAPL. I'm getting my information from the national president of the Sheriff's Association. He put out an article. He was up there, visited for a few days there and witnessed various things. And so all of my information I'm getting is from him. I'm not getting any information from DAPL. I'm not getting any information from the protesters.
Well, he speaks to the Morton Sheriff's Department here, and they are also they are in bed with DAPL, so they work together on this. Their militarized police forces work with the militarized security forces here, and so they are one.
Okay, we have to end our segment. Thank you very much, Christine Nobis, joining us from North Dakota, founder and co-founder. And co-chair of the Indigenous Iowa. She's a Native American who's lived in Iowa for 10 years on site in North Dakota. Greg Aylesbury, Boone County Sheriff, thank you so much for giving us law enforcement's perspective on the protests that seem to have subsided now here in Iowa over the Dakota Access Pipeline. Thank you.
And I thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll look at these in a little different light. Protests are theme this hour. Betty Andrews is with us of the NAACP. Also, historians Tim Walsh and Tom Moraine. We'll be back in just a moment. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking about protesting. Notable protests in this country over the past few months and years. Of course, Black Lives Matter protests have been going on since 2013. We had Election Day protests following the election of Donald Trump, but there was also a sort of condemnation of those protesters. The last half hour, we talked live with one particular person at the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota about the protests over the Dakota Access Pipeline construction. So we're talking about protests, how effective they are, what their goals are, how they are set in historical context. We'll talk with historians in just a moment. But first of all, let's talk with Betty Andrews. She is the president of the Iowa-Nebraska State Conference of the NAACP, has been in that position since 2013, also CEO of Betty Andrews Media in our Des Moines studio. Hi, Betty.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. I want to have you react to what we heard in the last half hour in a moment. But first, let's talk about Black Lives Matter. Beginning in 2013, that was after the acquittal of George Zimmerman in the shooting death of the African-American teen Trayvon Martin. Then came street demonstrations following the deaths in 2014 of two African-Americans, Michael Brown, that was in Ferguson. That resulted in protests, unrest in that city. Also then Eric Garner in New York City. And since the Ferguson protests, there have been all kinds of demonstrations against the deaths of numerous other African-Americans, by police actions or while those individuals were in police custody. And also, most recently, the Black Lives Matter activists became involved in the 2016 presidential election. Remind us, what are the grievances, the goals of Black Lives Matter?
Well, Ben, I don't presume to speak completely for Black Lives Matter, the organization, but I certainly can speak a little bit about the movement of Black Lives Matters, which is a little bit more organic. And I appreciate the opportunity to come on and talk about the opportunity to exercise the First Amendment right to protest. And that's really important because it signifies that that protesting is an American opportunity. And this country has its roots in protest. And I mean, just thinking about how the colonists began protesting against the British and people who came to this country for religious freedom and so on and so forth. So protest is not a new thing for America, and it's not a new thing that pertains only to African Americans or people of color. I think what we are in terms of the Black Lives Matter movement, it is kind of the perfect storm in the sense of being in an age where social media plays a huge role, where there are where video and technology play a huge role, and the opportunity to showcase some of the things that for many of us who are Black, like myself, who have grown up hearing about these things and knowing about these things. And these are the stories that have followed us historically in terms of being persecuted and being mistreated. And I think what a strong piece of the Black Lives Matter movement has been that cry of being mistreated along with the intersection of social media and being able to see these experiences happening on tape. Now, these are things that we've always known have happened, but to actually be able to see this with pictures and things like that. Mm-hmm. And in terms of how, you know, what the cry is and what the goal is, it has to do with, you know, Black Lives Matter, meaning that America should recognize that African Americans are equal. Their lives have value. They are as important as any other American. So when people say Black Lives Matter, it is a cry to say that our lives are valuable too.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how much you heard of the last half hour, but it sounds like Black Lives Matter has a kinship with the Native Americans protesting now in North Dakota.
And absolutely. As I was listening to the interview with Christine, I believe it was.
Yes, Christine.
And so many echoes of the civil rights movement were prevalent. And even the right to be heard, number one, and then also to protect those things that they hold sacred. And then also the echoes were about hearing the treatment of the protesters. You know, I'm concerned when I hear about certain gases and certain military tactics being used on protesters. And so when I hear that, it does definitely bring back visions of the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm. Betty Andrews is with us of the Iowa-Nebraska State Conference of the NAACP. Briefly, before we introduce a couple of other guests here, you've been a protester at various times in your life?
Absolutely. Well, I've been lots of times in my life because protest takes many forms. Way back in high school, protesting when they were turning Tech High into Central Campus, things like that. But also through the years, various protests about mistreatment of African Americans. I've been involved in a lot of the Black Lives Matter protests as a citizen, not necessarily involved as NAACP. But more recently, the NAACP's America's Journey for Justice, which was a 10,000 mile march dealing with criminal justice reform and the reform of other systems. And then also in Ferguson, we marched from Ferguson to Jeff City in Missouri with the NAACP to address the issue around the reason why Darren Wilson was not indicted and a number of those types of things. So I was able to see quite a bit. It was really interesting to see the reaction of people, everything from support to total disdain and things being hurled at us and just being reminded to keep stay focused on our goal.
Betty Andrews, we're also joined for the rest of the hour by Tim Walch. He is a presidential historian, also retired director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in our Iowa City studio. Always good to have you back on, Tim.
Thanks, Ben.
And Tom Moraine is with us, former administrator of the Iowa State Historical Society. Tom, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Currently teaching at Graceland University, where its main campus in Lamoni. I want to ask Tim and Tom for your historical perspective to root this in what we've talked about the Dakota Access Pipeline protests. We've talked a little bit there about the Black Lives Matter protests over the last couple of years. Tim, what are your insights here?
Well, I think Betty had it exactly right, and that is the whole protest movement has its roots in the sort of fundamental nature of the American experience, going back to the Stamp Act protests in 1765. To the Boston Tea Party in 1773 and on. Just about every generation finds itself with periods where it wants to exercise its free speech rights. There's frustration at the way either people or issues have been treated, and they manifest themselves in a vocal protest of activities. And often it starts with a very specific event, like the Tea Party. But it might very well start, as it did, say, in 1863 in New York with a protest over the draft. So these events show up very specifically, and then they grow into a larger movement, and there's an effort to try to rectify the injustice. And often it takes generations. I mean, the issues related to Black Lives Matter really go all the way back to the fundamental nature of slavery. You know, am I not a man? That graphic image was shown, and the abolition movement and the 13th Amendment. There's a new film out called 13, which reminds us where we were in the 19th century and yet how far we have to go.
Tom Moraine, what are your thoughts?
I like what Tim's saying about how it's rooted in the whole American experience. I'd like to point out, along with that, that some protests are very small, and the individual has done an outstanding job of bringing an issue to the public. I think of Edna Griffith's protest against the segregation of Katz Drugstore in downtown Des Moines. There were just three people, essentially, who carried posters who protested the segregation of an Iowa lunch counter. And I've sometimes wondered, the Jewish owners of a drugstore being put a parallel to Hitler right after World War II and the public dissonance that might have caused, but also the Tinker case in Roosevelt High School, where two students in high school and one in middle school simply wore black armbands to school to protest the Vietnam War, and the principal said, "That's not allowed, you're disruptive," and the Des Moines School Board upheld the principal, but it went to the U.S. Supreme Court, which ruled that students do not give up their First Amendment's rights to freedom of speech just because they come through the school door. And in those protests, it was a very, very small group who were not violent. They were not trying to create a crowd or disrupt anything. They were expressing their First Amendment right as a protest to the status quo, and it made a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Tim, tell us a little bit about the thinking of our founding fathers and the context of that day,
sure.
Because when this democracy, this republic was born, being allowed to protest was anything but a given.
No, absolutely true. And to some extent, this country's freedom of speech emerges out of its neglect from the English. We did not have the, in a way, the law enforcement presence in this country as colonies. The expectation is that the colonies would accept Parliament and its decisions on taxation. And what you had is a very bright, capable group of leaders here who understood that the sort of laissez-faire attitude toward the colonies allowed them to speak up and protest. And, of course, this does evolve into the American Revolution and to our success as a nation. So we've used speech and freedom as the fundamental pillars upon which this notion of American exceptionalism seems to grow. So that, and I suppose if you look back on the past, you'd say we're a very acrimonious people. But in a way, it's a celebration. You can see this in an optimistic fashion. That is, we've been able to vent our frustration over the way we've treated one another, and that friction has often led to real progress.
Tim Walsh is with us, along with Tom Moraine. Did you want to? We have a caller here. Tom, did you want to slip in something there?
I think that's an interesting angle, that history is written by the victors, and in the American Revolution, the protesters wrote the next Constitution, and the protesters wrote into that first Constitution of the United States the right to protest. I think that's a would we have got that 50 years later from the status quo establishment? I don't know. But the protesters in the American Revolution were the winners, and they wrote the next Constitution, which in the First Amendment guaranteed the right for public expression.
Just a quick follow-up on exactly what Tom is saying, and it's absolutely true. But there was skepticism on the part of the founders, because that friction led them to establish a government that was, a balanced government between three branches of government. And I remember that I didn't remember personally, but I read that Benjamin Franklin was asked at one time, Mr. Franklin, what kind of government do we have? A republic if you can keep it. And so that was always that point of friction that among the people trying to keep the government together.
If you can keep it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Betty, did you want to jump in quickly? Yeah, I mean, tying what we're talking about 230, 40 years ago into present day.
Well, I think it's important to note that I think it was Tom was saying, is that there are a number of opportunities in terms of protest and in terms of writing that history being something so much bigger than what's in front of you. And I think that that's part of what protest is, to be able to have your voice be heard. And like the lawsuit that ensued with the youth at Roosevelt, it's extremely important to understand that a protest can be something as small as an armband or something as big as thousands of people taking to the streets.
Mm-hmm. Let's get in one caller at least this hour. Susan in Grinnell is with us. Hi, Susan. You've been listening. What's on your mind?
Suzanne, yes.
Suzanne, sorry.
I just wanted to say that basically every right and law that we take for granted pretty much had its roots in a protest. So, child labor, women's right to vote, black people's right to vote, every law basically that we hold dear came because we shifted public opinion. How do we shift it? It was under pressure, and sometimes even when the protesters were not violent, the whole legacy of Pinkertons and others, there were people who died almost for every right that we hold dear now.
Susan, great point from Grinnell. Thank you. Yeah. Tom Moraine, build on that a little bit because you studied the specific cases there.
Well, I like what she said. And I think you have to remember the government, you don't need a right to say something good about the government. The government doesn't guarantee our right to say how well the government is doing or how much we like the status quo. That's sort of a given. What you need the right to say is that we want to change the status quo, and that's where the changes come about. So it is the right to provide an impetus to change that is embedded in the protest movement.
Okay, I wanted to play a little protest sound. One protest recently that we didn't mention here. Since Election Day, protests of President-elect Trump have sprung up across the nation. Here's a little sound from that. So, Tim Walsh, is this an aberration? Is this, how unique is this?
It is quite unusual. I cannot think of a political protest following an election. Of course, there were plenty of protests against candidates of the opposite party before the election, but throughout history, particularly because our elections have been so transparent and so clearly validated by commissioners of election, I can't think of a protest. And I think what it does is it reflects, I think, a certain apprehension about the future. So the protest itself is this friction between a change and a desire to sustain the status quo. And I think as frustrating as it has been with a government that doesn't seem to get very much done, there is an apprehension on the part of a sizable percentage of the people, maybe a majority of the people, that the future could be, disconcerting, to say the least.
Mm-hmm. Betty Andrews and then Tom after that. Do you see it the same way, Betty?
I see that this is a demonstration of anxiety and a concern for future well-being. Protest has always been just that, an expression of anxiety and looking to how we might change. And I also thought that there was something else that was there in that clip that sometimes people might forget about. And those were some of the chants that you heard. And those are opportunities, slogans, songs, and things like that. Opportunities to unify that base, which is important because that also addresses some of those concerns. The fact that you're not alone. There are a number of people that are just like you, and they are willing to stand and in some cases, as the caller mentioned, die for you. In the African American community, we have this saying, on their shoulders we stand. And literally talking about all of the people who gave their lives and gave their well-being to the movement and being able to stand on those shoulders and just kind of really signifying as to that there were people that fought for you to have certain rights. And that's what protesting has done over the years.
Mm-hmm. Tom Moraine, how do you view the post-election protests we've seen across the country, mostly in urban centers across the country, but also some here in Iowa?
I think one of the signal achievements of the American system has been our consistent, peaceful transfer of power, that the minority or the loser in an election may not like the results, but the loser retains the chance to change things in the future. And that's what the rights for protest are all about, to create a majority, to create a pressure in the future for change. I think it's sometimes hard for people to stand up and say, I lost this one, but we need to stand up for the process by which it was done. I don't like the results, but when my candidate wins, I want there to be public support for that. And sometimes in the moment, in the terrible disappointment, and in a very bipolar world, to say we need to stand up for the process and retain the integrity of the system, sometimes that's hard. I think as we get in further away from the election, the protests will die down, but someone needs to say the process needs to be, the integrity of the process needs to be maintained.
Mm-hmm. Although sometimes protesting is about standing against the process and the systems in order to change things and make things fair for everyone.
That's right.
Not necessarily speaking completely to this particular piece, but in general, that's also one of the objectives of protest.
Okay, very quickly, Tim Walsh, last word.
As a librarian, I'd like to put in a plug for a couple of books. Congressman John Lewis has a wonderful book called March that won the National Book Award that's out now. I encourage people to read that. And also David Meyer, M-E-Y-E-R, The Politics of Protest. It's a book from Oxford University Press, so if they're eager to learn more, those are a couple of great books to start with.
Thank you so much, Tim Walch, presidential historian, former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Tom Moraine, now at Graceland University, former administrator of the Iowa State Historical Society, and Betty Andrews of the NAACP. Betty, Tim, and Tom, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you so much, Ben.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.